Good evening. My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I'm a trustee of this wonderful library, and I'm delighted to welcome you tonight. Welcome to the New York Society Library, the oldest library in the city. In fact, Henry James' father was a library member, meaning that Henry James, in his youth, would have had access to the library in the same way that the young Edith Wharton did. And the library was started by a group of civic-minded people in 1754 in the hopes that the city would prosper. And in the hopes that the library will prosper, I ask you all to be generous with your contributions. And if you remember the library in your will, you get to come to a great party next year. So keep that in mind. And this evening, I am very honored to introduce Michael Gora, professor of English language and literature at Smith College. He works primarily with 19th and 20th century fiction, and his honors include fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities and a National Book Critics Circle Award. He has written introductions to novels. His essays have appeared in the Times Literary Supplement, the New York Times Book Review, the Hudson Review, and so many other places. And his books include The Bells in Their Silence, Travels Through Germany, After Empire, Scott Nepal Rushdie, and the English novel At Mid-Century. Tonight, he will be discussing his most recent and widely praised new book, Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece, which I have to say I have been reading on my Kindle. I'm sorry to say that because I love books, but I am missing my subway stops because the book is so engrossing and so good that I urge you all to read it. And it's described as a revelatory biography of James as told through the lens of his greatest novel. So many writers have embraced this book, including Brenda Wineapple, who's here tonight, Calm Toybean, Francine Prose, and others in every publication imaginable. Cynthia Ozick has this to say. In his resplendent Portrait of a Novel, Michael Gora breaks through the remoteness of the master, that majestic but privately enigmatic figure, so that Henry James comes to us with the sensuous immediacy of his quotidian reality. The rooms he lived in, the streets he trod, and the very texture of his inmost sensibility. And now, let us enter the world of Henry James by welcoming Michael Gora.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I don't get enough excuses to come to New York, so I'm delighted to have any chance. And thank you for that introduction. It's very kind. I'll have to live up to Cynthia Ozick's words. My talk, as Jeanette said, is drawn from my new book, Portrait of a Novel, but I'm not, of course, just going to read from the book. I'm going to talk about the book and about James himself by talking about houses, about the different houses, both real and imaginary, that play a role in the story, or rather the stories, of The Portrait of a Lady. Because I do think of myself as telling this novel's story. I tell the story of the novel, of how James came to write it, of what he did while he was working on it, of how it was published in 1881, and of its effect on both his personal and professional lives. But I also tell the story in the novel, moving back and forth between the work and the life, following the career of his heroine, Isabel Archer, an American girl set loose in Europe, and watching her as she makes the choices, or maybe the mistakes is a better word, that she so insists upon making. Now, one part of that story does indeed have to do with the literal and textual presence of a few particular houses. I'm going to begin with a metaphor, maybe James's most famous metaphor, a few lines from the preface to The Portrait of a Lady that he wrote in 1906. And he wrote the preface because he had decided 25 years afterwards that he wanted to revise the novel. He revised it for a collected edition. I'll be talking a little bit more about that as we go on. But in the preface, he writes, he offers a description of what he calls the house of fiction. a house that has, in short, not one window, but a million. A number of possible windows not to be reckoned, rather, every one of which has been pierced by the need of the individual vision and the pressure of the individual will. I think of this as like some enormous apartment house populated entirely by writers who stand at its different windows, and some of those windows, the windows are of different shapes and sizes. Some are broad or balconied or slit-like or low-browed. And through those windows, they gaze out at the world around them. And the different shapes of those openings work to frame their different visions, to determine the scope and angle of that vision. They're all watching a part of the same show, but each of them is making something different out of it. But anyone who's read The Portrait of a Lady will know that houses are never just metaphors. They're a guide to character and a motive for action. At times, they even seem like characters themselves. So I'm going to look at three houses today, three places that each have a role in my story, and we will hope that I can maneuver this. Yes. This is Lamb House. On the south coast of England. It's the place to which James moved in 1898 and where he wrote the words I've quoted. It was the only house he ever owned and where he worked on the preface to the portrait. The second is a country house named Hardwick in the Thames Valley. It's the original of Garden Court where the novel begins, and if it's out of focus, that's because I took it. The third is the villa in Florence where James puts his villain, Gilbert Osmond. And it's modeled on a place called the Villa Castellani. In each case, that house will give us some sense of just how Henry James worked. So I'll begin with Lamb House. Many years later, he would remember the way the book had begun. He was old then and in England, at home in the place he had made for himself, a brick 18th century house in the small Sussex town of Rye. It was a marsh country once known for its shipwrecks and smugglers, 30 miles down the channel from Dover, an odd place for an American novelist, and an odder one for a man whose habits were all of them urban, a man of clubs and cabs, of dinner parties and first nights. He was a famous man with elaborate manners and kind, and yet someone whose eyes could seem to drill your spine with their knowledge. Famous, but now too little read, as his royalty figures all too often reminded him. Sometimes he joked about how little his books brought in. His good friend Edith Wharton might sell enough to buy a new automobile. His own checks, he claimed, would only cover the cost of a wheelbarrow. He'd been in Europe for 30 years. It had been the great adventure of his life, or rather, it had made other adventures possible, the adventure contained in the litter of printed sheets on his desk. His agent had taken two copies of one of his early novels and cut their bindings, and then pasted each page onto a larger sheet. Now he had a single unbound copy with a few inches of white space on either side of the page, plenty of room to scrawl. He dipped his pen and blackened half a line of type, wrote four words in the margin, and then drew a circle around them with a faint thread of ink, tethering them to their place in his paragraph. He blotted two more lines, got rid of a character's name, substituted the words, "our friend." He italicized a word of dialogue. Most 19th century novelists touched up their work in the months between its first publication in a magazine and its appearance as a bound volume. A serial installment might have been rushed to make a deadline, trimmed to match the space. But James took the business of revision much further than that. He lived in a world of second thoughts, and he believed that almost every one of his sentences could stand a little work. He could hardly bear to reread his earlier things, except with a pen in his hand, making changes as he went, even if those changes were for his eyes only. There's a great story of his, The Middle Years, in which he gives that habit to one of his characters. And, you know, he starts writing in the margins of his book when he gets the first copy, and somebody picks it up off a table, doesn't know him, and thinks, wait a minute, what are you doing making these changes? Who are you? James did that to himself. Now, the sheets on his desk were from a book he'd written a quarter of a century ago, in 1881. The Portrait of a Lady was the novel in which, after a long and careful apprenticeship, he'd first allowed his imagination full stretch. It had been his first true success. And though as a young man he'd made fun of the idea of the great American novel, greatness had always been on his mind. He'd taken pains with the book, and it had changed his reputation. It had made him important enough to be attacked, and now it was going to have a new life. Now, James at this point, when he starts doing these revisions in 1906, he's in his early 60s, and he's thinking of his posterity, not so much of his own personal future as of the future of his work, the face he would present to that posterity. So he'd arranged, as I've suggested, for the publication of a definitive edition of his work, which he called the New York edition because he'd been born here. The early books that had made his name, stories like Daisy Miller, novels like The Portrait, they were going to have their surfaces retouched, their style nudged into line with that of his later work. Some of those revisions proved extensive. On this book in particular, there's something new in almost every paragraph, let alone every page. And to each volume, he added a preface, what he called a frank, critical talk about its origin, its place. So in the evenings, he took up his old pages. Mornings were for new work, three concentrated hours that began around 10. In the spring of 1906, that was a travel book called The American Scene. It's based upon his recent visit to the United States. Almost every corner of Lamb House gave James a place in which to write. But in warm weather, his favorite was a place called the Garden Room. It was detached from the house itself. It was a studio that he entered from his acre of walled garden. And unfortunately, it no longer stands. A German bomb took it out in 1940. So in visiting Lamb House today, and you can visit it, it's owned by the National Trust, it's open twice a week, you'll only find the brick outline of his studio on the grass. But we do have old photographs. And they show it as rather uncluttered, almost as though cleared for action. It was a room big enough and open enough for James to pace. And pictures suggest that he liked to tuck his left thumb inside his waistcoat, inside his waistcoat, in the armhole. His hesitant and at times stammering voice gaining in assurance as it rolled from sentence to sentence. And as he talked, his words would be answered by the sputter and clack of a Remington typewriter. Because he wasn't alone in that room. He shared it with a young woman from a London secretarial agency whom he'd hired to take down his dictation. James had been dictating at this point for about a decade. 30 years of his own almost entirely illegible handwriting had cramped his arm. We'd now call it repetitive motion injury. He now saved it as much as he could, so he'd hired a secretary. Dictation made concision impossible. It was always going to be hard for him, but dictating made it even harder. It let him just roll on from clause to clause. The speaking voice let him stretch his sentences out with one qualification after another. But he liked having a clean page on which to revise, and by now the typewriter's sound provided an aid to concentration. So did the occasional cigarette. That was the morning. Then lunch, a walk through rye's grassy cobbled streets, a few hours to cover a few miles, his way broken by the small talk of a small town, chat with neighbors, a greeting to the fishmonger. And in the early evening, he sat down to his revisions. For as he himself wrote, the hours from 5 to 8 can be a little eternity. And with a soft summer light holding back the dusk. And I like to think of him as spending that time in the garden room, in the pleasure and the slow care of his work. There's an hour yet before dinner, and his pen scratches over the page, each sheet marked by a delta of wavy lines, each stream attached to a small lake of new words. He's near the end, and he blackens out a phrase. He puts an extra degree of effusion into a character's voice. He He allows his heroine a sentence of struggling comprehension, and now he's pleased. He's mended some infelicities. He's clarified his character's motives. He's stretched and strengthened the metaphoric fibers of his prose. And when James began to talk his way through the novel's preface, well, he found a kind of romance in recovering the days of its origin. He would sit in thought while his typist waited at her keys. Then he was on his feet, and the past was in his hands. First came the memory of Florence in the spring, where he began the novel at a hotel room over the Arno, with, as he said, the little buildings of the Ponte Vecchio virtually at his feet. Then Venice the following year, and the memory of how the ceaseless human chatter came in at my windows, to which I seemed to myself to have been constantly driven in the fruitless fidget of composition, as though the happy sail of the right word were somewhere out there in the blue. He paces, pauses, and a sentence floats on the air, a memory of the single small cornerstone with which he'd begun, the conception of a certain young woman affronting her destiny. His heroine had stood there all alone in his mind, unsupported at first by family or friends or any shred of a narrative. No supporting characters, no plot yet, just her. And then one morning he woke up in possession of his other characters, and Henry James set himself to the job of organizing an ado about Isabel Archer. I'll move into the second part of my talk now about Gardencourt, the English country house. And those of you who've read the book will remember that we first see Isabel just after she arrives in Britain. She's traveling from her family home in upstate New York. She's standing in the doorway of an English country house and gathering herself to walk out onto the stage of her life, where she'll join a group gathered around a tea table. Now, a door is a door, and we don't need to see it symbolically to know that the act of walking through one can be momentous. It's an entrance, an incident of passage, of transition. But this particular door also provides a kind of frame in which the girl stands as if for her portrait. The door isolates her. It gives her a border. It makes her into a picture. As she pauses to look out at the scene before her, at the shade trees, the carpet of turf, the hill running down to the Thames, she looks out, and then one of the other characters looks at her and sees her in that door. In every window of the house of fiction, there stands a watcher, the consciousness of the artist, who will make some meaning from the scene outside. I like to imagine us as reading that scene over Isabel's shoulder, over the artist's shoulder, rather, our eyes following his. We might also think of Isabel in that doorway as making up a story about the people she sees on the lawn, a story about the world she's about to join. Perhaps, indeed, her very position in that doorway is one of the things that 25 years later would give James that wonderful metaphor. Yet leave that image aside for now. What about this house, this place that James called Gardencourt? It's owned by a family named Touchett. Mrs. Touchett is Isabel's aunt on her mother's side. And her husband, Daniel, though he was born in Vermont, has made a great fortune as a London banker. The lawn outside has been furnished with rugs and chairs, books and tables, as though it were a room, and as though Isabel were looking not outside, but in. It's a place of comfort and ease. And I've always felt that to read of it is to wish that you were a part of it. So Isabel can't help herself when she walks out there and her cousin Ralph Touchett, he murmurs the name of another guest to her. "Oh, I hoped there would be a lord," she said. "It's just like a novel." Because Isabel has now stepped inside her own story. It's a story that comes with a lord in a country house, a ghost, and even a palace in Rome, with everything that one wants a certain kind of novel to have. It's a gesture that weds her love of the props and furniture of fiction to her own Anglophilia. It's a gesture that serves to license such guilty pleasures of our own. Now, we know that James had a particular young woman in mind as a model for Isabel, a first cousin named Minnie Temple, who died in her 20s of tuberculosis. We know that. We know it because Minnie's friends recognized her in the pages of the Atlantic Monthly when the novel first began to be serialized. They recognized her, they wrote to James about it, and in answering them, James admitted it. But he cautioned them against taking Isabel as a direct portrait. Poor Minnie, he wrote, was essentially incomplete. And I've tried to make my young woman more rounded, more finished. His cousin's illness meant that she didn't have the chance to become the person into whom time and life might have made her, time and experience. She didn't have the chance to grow, the chance that Isabel herself will have. Still, James's extrapolation, his imagination of Isabel's career, is in one sense a development out of Minnie's own family circumstances. In 1906, he suggested that a photographer take a picture of a particular English house to use as a frontispiece to the revised edition of The Portrait of a Lady. Quote, "A view of the English country house, Hardwick, near Pangbourne on the Thames, which I had vaguely and approximately in mind years ago for the opening of the portrait. The place belonged to a member of Parliament named Charles Rose, whom James had known since his early days in England. And in writing, James remembered that he had been staying there with him. Now, an image of the house did indeed become the novel's frontispiece. But the details of any trip, any visit that James himself might have made to Hardwick Court are now irrecoverable. No correspondence with Rose survives, and James nowhere else mentions the place. Still, I'm going to posit a visit sometime in the summer of 1877, second half of 1877. That was the year Rose took up residence at Hardwick, leasing the estate at first and then later buying it. And in a letter, James mentions dining with him in London around that time. The novelist had only moved to England a few months before, and he'd had very few country invitations as yet. But this one would have been apt to follow for reasons that I'll detail in a moment. It's a brick building of the Tudor period, a good deal bruised and defaced in Cromwell's wars, as James writes, some 40 miles upstream from London. The words I've quoted are James's about the defacement. But the facts are confirmed by the architectural historian Nicholas Pevsner, whose description of the house is almost word for word like James's. Both writers note the irregularity of its bricks and gables. The house sits on a low rise above the water, with a steep hill rising directly behind, and its view across the river to the hedged fields beyond is very little changed from what it would have been in James's day. It's still an agricultural part of England. I spent a summer morning there a few years ago, driving down from Oxford through one impeccable village after another, swooping at last downhill into Whitchurch on Thames, turning into a narrow lane just before reaching the river. The house was a mile on, and the fields along the way were, well, they weren't filled with sheep or cows. They were filled with llamas. Hundreds of spitting long-necked llamas. A neighbor's farm. Hardwick still belongs to the Rose family, though the current owner of the place was absent. He's gone in for organic farming in Poland in a big way. But the estate's manager showed me over the house and grounds, the library with its elaborately plastered ceiling from the time of Elizabeth I, the direction from which carriages would once have approached. It's surrounded by gravel walks, avenues of old trees channel one's vision down to the water. There is indeed a great spread of lawn on which you can imagine having tea. The Thames runs placidly here. And a 1906 article from Country Life claims, "There is no more beautiful reach of the river than that upon which the Hardwick terraces look down." It isn't a grand place. Not a powerhouse. Not a place of lordly display. And yet it is a striking one, this substantial family home with its 1,000 acres of mixed farming and timber, close to London, but marked with an enduring sense of privacy. Other estates along the Thames have a description and a history that can match it, but James had a particular reason for drawing on this one. Minnie Temple's mother had been a James, the sister of the novelist's father. She was the writer's first cousin on her mother's side. And Charles Rose, a London banker turned country squire, was her first cousin on her father's. Let me trace the genealogy, and I'll do this as quickly as I can. The Temples came from Rutland, Vermont. Daniel Touchett's hometown, in fact. So the Temples came from Rutland, Vermont, which is Daniel Touchett's hometown, as I've said. Robert Temple married Catherine James, that is, the novelist's aunt. They had 6 children, Minnie among them. In 1943, Robert Temple's sister Charlotte married a Scottish-born Montreal lawyer named John Rose, who over the next 20 years became one of Canada's most successful financiers. Rose returned to Britain in 1869, and he set up a merchant bank that specialized in railroads, which were the era's most lucrative investments. He also served as an unofficial representative of the Canadian government and was made a baronet in 1872. Now, James liked the Rose children, but he kept his distance from the formidable woman he called Aunt Charlotte, refusing several invitations to stay with her. For me, the real interest here lies in the figure of Sir John Rose. Not the historical person, but rather the man seen in terms of his family position. Because he's the uncle by marriage who Minnie Temple would have visited if she'd ever been well enough to travel abroad, just as Isabel visits and becomes very fond of her uncle by marriage. So the situation into which Isabel steps has a much closer resemblance to that of James's own extended family than most scholars have noted, even though as people, the Roses have almost nothing in common with the Touchetts. For example, family tradition holds that Charles Rose served as the model for Mr. Toad in The Wind in the Willows. I have to say, I've checked this out, and I mean, this is from Burke's Landed Gentry, so the entry they've put in there. I've checked this out in the Kenneth Graham biographies, and there's no mention of the Roses, but it was his stretch of river that Graham had in mind. The Dictionary of National Biography describes Sir John Rose as, quote, dying of a heart attack brought on by the excitement of shooting a stag. It's hard to imagine the shrewd but modest Daniel Touchett doing that. I think as a character, as a temperament, he owes less to Sir John Rose than he does to an American banker named Russell Sturgis. He's a member of an old Salem, Massachusetts family who in Britain became a director of Barings Bank. James spent some of his Christmases with the Sturgises. Their son Howard became one of his closest friends. Now, this hunting for an original might seem a bit of very old gossip, except that doing so can tell us something about the way in which James worked, the way his imagination functioned. Isabel, we can see, is developing, indeed, out of his cousin. Minnie's the starting point, although the great lady we see later on in the novel has very little in common with the girl spitting blood in New York. But she's a special case. Looking at Mr. Touchett can show us something that I think is more typical of James's usual practice. His character isn't so much a composite as he is a laminate, which James has glued the temperament of one banker onto the position of another, to the family of another. Now, let me end this part of my talk by reminding us of the scene into which Isabel steps when she first moves onto that lawn. The men talk companionably, and yet old Mr. Touchett strikes a curious note, for he announces his belief that there will be great changes and not all for the better. Now, it is the kind of thing that old men say. not something in which we should, I think, try very hard to find a large social meaning. Yet it does tell us something about the novel itself. It won't be all tea parties. Isabel may see herself as having stepped inside a novel, but not all novels end well. Third part, the Villa Castellani. Now, one of the great things about writing this book was that I had to go to Italy. And I had to go again and again and again. And really the only thing, the saddest thing about finishing the book, because writing it was an utter joy, but the saddest thing about finishing it is now I need to find a new excuse. So one morning in Florence, I paused at the foot of the Ponte Vecchio and looked back. I turned away from the river for a view of the buildings that faced it. One of them had been a place called the Hotel dell'Arno, where in an upstairs room, James had sat in 1880, making Isabel take her first steps onto that lawn. But too much had been rebuilt here for me even to speculate about what window had been his. It was all gelaterias and necktie shops and ATMs. So I shrugged and walked on, you know, over the river, past the Palazzo Pitti, past Machiavelli's house, and then on through the old Porta Romana, where I began to climb. Here the city's fabric loosened. Through heavy gates I had an occasional view of a villa, of a mustard-colored building set back in a garden of umbrella pines and olives. And as the road climbed, the villas got larger and larger, security more elaborate, so signs would warn you about dogs. There was barbed wire on top of the walls. The walls had a lot of broken glass on top of them. If you're an aching alien, James wrote, half the talk is about villas. This one has a story. That one has another. And I think by now, a lot of those stories have an American twist. In 1858, for example, Hawthorne had rented a place called the Torre, the Tower di Montotto, on top of Bello Sguardo, the hill I was now climbing toward. It cost him $28 a month. He said he got a place big enough to quarter a regiment in, and later on he used it as a setting in the Marble Faun. My destination was a place James had described as a little grassy, empty, rural piazza. And I read that too quickly. A little grassy, empty, rural piazza. He stretches you out with those commas. With a long, rather blank-looking front. The grass was gone. And that didn't stop a boy from kicking a soccer ball up against the gates of the houses. But the house was still there. Like many such places, it's carried several names, and for much of its life, it was called the Belvedere al Saracino. In the 20th century, it became known as the Villa Mercedes, and it did time as a finishing school for American girls. James knew it as the Villa Castellani, and some family friends of his had an apartment there. Friends named Boot. James had known the widowed Frank Boot and his daughter Elizabeth in Newport and Cambridge. Elizabeth was a few years younger than he was. She'd also been a friend of Minnie Temple. Boot had gone to Italy at mid-century. His wife had just died. He had a substantial share in a Lowell textile mill. He just went and lived on the proceeds. And in doing so, he gave himself over to the care and education of his daughter, whom James remembered as the markedly produced Lizzie. He remembered her as infinitely civilized, a girl toned as from steeping in a rich old medium. Oh, that's the house, of course. That's Lizzie. It's a painting by a man named Frank Duveneck, who was at first her painting teacher, as a Cincinnati-born artist. At first her teacher, and then they married. And had a child, and she died a couple of years after the marriage. I forget from what sort of fever, but died quite young, in her mid-40s. James wrote about the Villa Castellani in three different works. His 1875 novel, Roderick Hudson, an 1878 essay called Italy Revisited, and finally in The Portrait. Now, in the first of these, he calls it the Villa Pandolfini. It's a building with a long, rather low facade, colored a dull, dark yellow, I'll go back to there. It's yellowish now, not really yellow. Pierced with windows of various sizes. Inside, the rooms themselves were as cool as royal sepulchres, while the garden behind swells with figs and olives and offers a prospect of the river valley below. It was a place and a view that he never quite learned, as he put it, not to covet. And he loved both the cypresses outside and the sense within of a place dedicated to the love of art and of beauty. Now, the facade, as you'll see, remains with those windows in irregular positions. It's modest, however. It's almost anonymous, the building. It sits directly on the street. There's no broken glass here. There are no dogs. There's no barbed wire. If we had a good map of Florence, I could show you all how to get there. The gate stood open, and a caretaker waved me into the lichen-covered courtyard. There was a well in one corner, and a Vespa in another. There was a pet cemetery. And I noted the names on the mailboxes of the dozen flats into which the place is now divided. So German, a Scandinavian, and then a lot of Italians, among them somebody actually named Corleone. There was one English name, a place belonging to someone who called himself Lawrence of Florence. In one of his Italian travel essays, James describes himself, he's in Siena, he's peeping up the one stately staircase, one palazzo doorway after another, and wishing that he had the courage to sort of just walk up and knock. And he wanted a view of the life within, the kind of life that every tourist wants to see. So for a moment, I really did pause with my finger over Lawrence's doorbell, wondering just who might appear. But I don't have any more courage than James did, and I did leave that bell unrung. So I've got to rely instead on his own description of the interior. This comes in chapter 22 of the portrait, when the book jumps in both time and place. He throws the action 6 months forward and rather suddenly moves all his major characters to Italy, introducing some new ones in the process. Here the villa goes nameless, but the language he uses for it has a new figurative power. The building seems incommunicative. Its facade shows not its face, but its mask. It had heavy lids, but no eyes. The face is really on the back, where you look off over the river. Heavy lids, but no eyes. The place is not what it seems. Or maybe the people are not what they seem. His different apartments are occupied mainly by foreigners, he writes, foreigners long resident in Florence. And in one of them, James shows us a room furnished with pieces of tapestry, cabinets of age-polished oak, oddments of medieval brassware, and a wall of early masters in frames pedantically rusty. In this apartment, there lives a man named Gilbert Osmond, a widower of 40, and a father, with a daughter in her teens named Pansy. Now, I won't review the history that James provides for Osmond or describe Isabel's first visit to that hillside. I won't rehearse the details of the plot in which she's soon ensnared. But James does write that his heroine almost immediately begins to tell herself a story about a quiet, clever, sensitive, distinguished man strolling on a moss-covered terrace and holding by the hand a little girl. It's the story of a man who has, she believes, made a choice between a shallow life and a serious one. And his studious life in a lovely land appears to her inseparable from the widower's half-anxious, half-helpless fatherhood. Now, this is the man James's heroine will marry, as I suppose most of us know. Isabel will make him wait, but a dozen chapters on, she will marry him, and nobody has ever been happy about this. Nobody has ever thought she made a good choice. But it's easy to condemn the match. I think we need instead to try to understand it. And in keeping with my theme, with the idea of houses, the houses of the fiction, I'm going to try to understand it in terms of something that another character says, a woman named Madame Merle. Some of you will remember that Edith Wharton's first book was called The Decoration of Houses. This is something that Gilbert Osmond could give lessons in. Your rooms, Madame Merle tells him, are perfect. You understand this sort of thing as no one else does. He's not rich, but with modest means, he's worked to great effect. And really, if the Victorians had had shelter magazines, he'd be in them. His place would be in them. This sort of thing is an art in itself, the perfectly upholstered daily life. And we have to take it seriously before we take it lightly. Now, you'll remember that Isabel unexpectedly inherits 70,000 pounds from Mr. Touchett. It's hard to estimate just how much this would be today. Different economists give very different multipliers, anywhere between 30 and 200, depending on whether you're looking just at inflation or at the costs of goods and services. The money's left in bank stock, which is a very good rate of return in the 19th century. And conservative estimates are that Isabel could spend about 5,000 pounds a year. If you remember Pride and Prejudice, that's not Darcy's money, but it's Bingley's money. And of course, 5,000 pounds a year went much further in Rome than it does in London, aside from the fact that you get the painted ceilings and the frescoes for free. James himself never had anywhere like that amount of money. At this point, he had no family money. Towards the end of the 19th century, he did get a little bit of family money, maybe 600 or 700 pounds a year. At this point, when his career is really on a roll, he's topping out at about 1,100 or 1,200 pounds a year. And many years after this, he made much, much less. Isabel finds the scale of her inheritance a burden. She thinks it's embarrassing. It's indelicate. And she's going to look to good taste itself as a way to redeem it. Good taste, Osmond's taste, will give her a note of distinction, something that will go beyond, that will be better and greater than the mere fact of money. And James himself shared that prejudice. He shared it even as he also saw through it. He delighted in things old and obscure. In his fiction, he often makes an eye for them serve as a mark of intelligence. But he also knew how unsustaining good taste alone might prove, because that's all that Osmond has. He's an aesthete with a very good eye, but no more. He paints a little, but he's no artist himself. He's at best a copy of a copy. One of the great moments in the novel, in fact, comes late when James describes him as drawing a copy of an etching of a coin. And of course, no spoiler here, he does turn out to be much worse than he seems. He's a man wicked enough to have been played by John Malkovich. Still, if he were really the kind of man Isabel takes him for, he might be attractive. That is, he'd be rather like Frank Boot, the real-life Bostonian in whose apartment James puts him. A man who accepted his limits and decided to cultivate his own garden. Boot wrote music. He was a serious, though still amateur composer, but his music was sometimes performed. He was a more sociable man than Osmond, a very good host, and a more genuinely devoted father. His daughter, Lizzie, had tutors in Florence, rather than being packed off to a convent, as Osmond does with his girl. That alone should be enough to caution anyone who wants to claim, as critics sometimes have, that the one family was based upon the other, the Osmonds upon the Boots. Indeed, the difference between them seems so great as once more to make me doubt the utility of looking for originals. Yet the search for some putative original does allow us to see what was in fact created. The difference between the page and the gravel of documentary truth can stand as a guide to artistic practice. So matching the description of the hill of the villa up against the portrait of a lady, matching that description in the novel up against an actual walk there, that suggests the degree to which James's Italian settings are in fact traceable to particular sites. The people he puts in those settings are a different matter entirely. Isabel's an exception, as I've said, but very few of James's other characters, of his important characters, have a source in a particular person, or rather, his character's characters, their moral being, their personalities, they don't have that source. What James does instead is to take a person, take not a person, but a set of circumstances from the life around him. So in the Villa Castellani, he had an American father, a widower, and an aesthete who devoted his life to the education of his daughter. The situation planted itself in his brain, and it waited there until he could use it, until, as he wrote in his autobiography, an Italianate bereft American with a little molded daughter proved exactly what his work required. I had it there, he adds. And he had it all the more because Frank Boot had no single note of character or temper in common with my Gilbert Osmond. I see no reason to doubt James's claim there. What he got from his family friends, what they suggested, what he used, what he could adapt to the tale in his mind, was the drama of their position, not that of their particular individual beings. Gilbert Osmond is an interesting creation precisely because he differs from the man in whose house James put him. Now let me move towards an end, and I'll do so by returning to the question of windows. Those in Osmond's villa, James writes, are in irregular relation to one another. Their sizes don't match. They aren't evenly distributed as they would be in a properly Renaissance building. And in that, they remind me of the description that James would offer many years later of what he called the house of fiction, where all the windows are indeed of different sizes and shapes. I'd hesitate to suggest that the Villa Castellani is in itself the origin of James's imagery. And the language in which he defines that metaphor has, of course, another source. We can trace his evocation of the million windows of the house of fiction to Christ's words in the Gospel of John, "In my Father's house there are many mansions." Nevertheless, the scale of the house James imagines, so many windows all giving on to different scenes, revealing different aspects of the human life outside, that architectural image does indeed owe something to his experience of Italy. He eventually collected his travel essays under the title of Italian Hours. And over again in that book, he evokes the spectacle of the Italian palazzo, the Palazzo Strozzi in Florence, say, the Barbaro in Venice, where much of The Wings of the Dove is set, the Barberini in Rome, houses of an extraordinary size and proportion, and too grand, he says, for ordinary human life. Even in their 19th century decrepitude, these houses spoke of an elevation and extent. They round their great arches and intersperse their huge windows with a proud indifference to the cost of materials. Thick of wall and marked by a solidity of staircase and a superfluity of stone, these houses can exalt the people who live in them. They can give their inhabitants the breadth and the generously proportioned vision of their own rooms and windows. So it is in the greatest novels of James's day. So it is in this one. Those novels exalt us when we read them. They exalt their characters. They make us see the value, the importance, the sheer interest of every individual person. It was no accident that in writing about what he had achieved in The Portrait of a Lady, Henry James found his guiding metaphor in the grandest kind of domestic architecture. Thank you. They've told me there is time for questions, and so I'm happy to take questions if people want, or when I sign books, as you wish. Yes.